He's in.
Okay. Yeah, why don't we go ahead?
City Council will come to order. Connor, please call the roll.
Adams. Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Sten.
Here.
Potter.
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent. Please read the 2 p.m. time certain.
Item 402, Appeal of East Columbia Neighborhood Association against the hearing officer's decision to approve the application of Howard Brandwine and Jerry Geblin for a zoning map amendment to change the base zone from RF to R10 in conformance with the comprehensive plan designation for a site located at 9801 Northeast 13th Avenue, LU07-140-167-ZC.
The city attorney will describe the hearings process.
This is an on-the-record hearing. This means you must limit your testimony to material and issues in the record. During this hearing, you may only talk about the issues, testimony, exhibits, and other evidence that were presented at the earlier hearing before the hearings officer. You may not bring up anything new. This hearing is designed only to decide if the hearings officer made the correct decision based on the evidence that was presented to him. If you start to talk about new issues or try to present new evidence today, you may be interrupted and reminded that you must limit your testimony to the record. We'll begin with a staff report by the Bureau of Development Services staff for approximately 10 minutes. Following the staff report, City Council will hear from interested persons in the following order. The appellant will go first and have 10 minutes to present their case. Following the appellant, persons who support the appeal will go next. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak to Council. The three-minute time limit applies regardless of whether you're speaking for yourself or on behalf of an organization. The principal opponent, in this case the applicant, will then have 15 minutes to address Council and rebut the appellant's presentation. After the principal opponent, Council will hear from persons who oppose the appeal. If there is no principal opponent, the Council will move directly to testimony from persons who oppose the appeal after supporters of the appeal conclude their testimony. Again, each person will have 3 minutes each. Finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes to rebut the presentation of opponents of the appeal. Council may then close the hearing, deliberate, and take a vote on the appeal. If the vote is a tentative vote, Council will set a future date for the adoption of findings and a final vote on the appeal. If Council takes a final vote today, that will conclude the matter before Council. Again, I'll remind you it's an on-the-record hearing, which means you must limit your remarks to arguments and evidence in the record compiled by the hearings officer. You may refer to evidence previously submitted to the hearings officer. You may not submit new evidence. If your argument includes new evidence or issues, Council will not consider it, and it will be rejected in Council's final decision. If you believe a person who addressed Council today improperly presented new evidence or presented a legal argument that relies on evidence not in the record, you may object to that argument here today. Finally, under state law, only issues that were raised before the hearings officer may be raised in this appeal to Council. If you believe another person has raised issues today that were not raised there, you may object to Council's consideration of those issues.
Thank you. Do any members of the council wish to declare a conflict of interest? No council members have a conflict of interest to declare. Do any members of councils have any ex-party contacts to declare or information gathered outside of the hearing to disclose?
I do. Members of the East Columbia Neighborhood Association made an appointment, came into my office to discuss with me this matter. I made it clear to them that I couldn't take a position and would listen only, and could not draw any conclusions based on their presentation until after this hearing.
Do any members of council have questions or other preliminary matters that need to be addressed before we begin the hearing? We'll begin the hearing with a 10-minute presentation from BDS staff.
Thank you. My name is Stephanie Beckman. I'm senior planner with the Bureau of Development Services. And I'm going to go over the proposal today, the hearings officer decision, and cover the appeal points real briefly. So the purpose of today's hearing is to consider an appeal of the hearings officer's decision to approve a zoning map amendment. The appellant is the East Columbia Neighborhood Association, represented by Mary Helen Kincaid. The applicant is Howard Brandwine and Jerry Geblin, represented by Christopher Kobach, their attorney. And the decision before council is to uphold with modifications or overturn the hearings officer's decision. Summary of the proposal. Again, it's a zoning map amendment to change the zoning of a little over 22-acre site from RF, which is residential farm forest, to R10 in conformance with a comprehensive plan designation for the site. The proposal is evaluated against the approval criteria for base zone changes, which is a very narrow set of approval criteria focused on the availability of public services. The applicant in this situation did not provide a specific development proposal, so we're just looking at services to the site from the surrounding area. There's no actual development proposal at this time. This shows the existing zoning. Again, it's RF with a comprehensive plan designation in parentheses of R10. The RF zone allows one dwelling unit per 2 acres of site area, very low density, which would amount to approximately 9 lots on this property. One other thing that I would point out on the property is that there is a small area at the very southern portion of the property that has environmental conservation, the small C zoning, and that's running along a drainage canal that runs along the southern border of the property. This map is also helpful just to get a lay of the land here. Site fronts on Northeast 13th. Marine Drive is to the north, and then to the south of the property is Northeast Gertz Road. You'll also note that there is R10 zoning surrounding the property. There's also commercial to the north and a little bit of industrial and employment zoning in the immediate vicinity of the property. This shows the proposed zoning of R10, which would allow one dwelling unit per 10,000 square feet of site area, which is approximately 82 lots for single-family homes. Those numbers that I've given are based on the assumption that there would be some sort of street network put in place when the site developed to serve the new homes, which reduces the allowed density slightly. This is an aerial photograph showing the property. There is a little bit of development on the property at the eastern end. There's a single-family home and a few accessory structures, including a large barn-type structure. This shows the general location of the 100-year floodplain and wetlands on the property and open channels. The blue is floodplain, the green is wetland, and then there, like I said before, there is a drainage channel along the southern portion of the property that's operated by the Peninsula Drainage District.
So if I could ask you why we're there, can they build in the proposal on the floodplain and or wetlands?
Well, I think that's probably a big reason of why we're here. The floodplain and wetlands do not have any environmental zoning over them. They don't have protection under the code or under the city zoning code.
And why is that?
Because the environmental zone is the mechanism that the city has to protect environmental resources. And so for some reason, when these were inventoried or when the environmental zones were put in place in this area, they weren't put over these water features. So at this point, they can't build in them as the property sits now, but there aren't protections in place to keep the property from being changed, for example, filling of the wetland areas. The applicant is pursuing grading permits and with the city and wetland fill permits with the Army Corps of Engineers and Division of State Lands, who do have jurisdiction over these resources right now.
I guess the obvious question is how is it that we have overlays on other wetlands and floodplains and not this one? Were you saying it was on omission?
I really can't answer that question. What I can tell you is that they were identified in a 1990 study of the area, the East Columbia Natural Resources Management Plan, and they were given a very low rating in terms of the resource value. And it appeared as though there was some assumption that there would be some fill to make land, you know, developable. So I haven't done all the research to go back and find out why in the 90s there wasn't environmental zoning placed on this property. But does that answer your questions?
No, but that's, I hear what you're saying.
This is a conceptual development plan, and I want to be real clear that this was not submitted as part of the zoning map amendment application packet. Like I said before, the applicant is pursuing permits to grade the property and basically to facilitate this type of development plan where they would have development clustered on the eastern portion of the property and I think some mitigated wetland area on the western portion. I have a few photos of the site and the area. This is along the frontage of Northeast 13th. Again, looking across to a site across the street from 13th. This is right at the entrance to the property. This is the driveway leading up to the house. This is, again, at the entrance to the property. There is an opened pond up at the eastern portion here. And a close-up view of that same shot.
So that pond is an example of something that would be filled in?
If the permits are granted from Division of State Lands, I believe that is part of their proposal. This is the existing large single-family home on the property. This is looking across one of the ponds, again, at the large barn structure. And then this is further out into the western portion of the site, which is largely kind of appears to be a large open field with some trees and vegetation around the outer area. Again, just another shot of the interior of the site. This is another pond area towards the northern portion of the property. And then this is the drainage canal that is along the southern portion of the property. Again, as I mentioned earlier, administered by the Peninsula Drainage District. So they said the hearings officer held a hearing on the case and found that all city service bureaus, including the Peninsula Drainage District, reviewed the proposal and found that services are adequate to support the requested zone change. I can go through those individually if you like, but essentially the only two service providers that asked for more information were police and transportation, raised some concerns about one intersection in the vicinity of the area, and additional information was provided. And based on that information, all of the service bureaus found that they could serve the increased in density to the on the property. The hearings officer also found that concerns raised about potential future development of the site were not relevant to this review because of the narrow focus on adequacy of services under the zoning map amendment criteria. And the hearings officer approved the requested zone change. In terms of appeal issues, the Neighborhood Association has questioned the finding of adequate public services. Specifically, they have asked for, have noted the lack of a specific plan for extension of services into the site, not just providing them at the frontage of the property, but actually extending into the site through some of the environmental areas, environmentally sensitive areas that you saw. And then they've also questioned whether or not there would be cumulative impacts of development in the area based on the amount of development potential in the area in general. They also raised environmental impacts as a concern about the impact of any future development of the property, including flooding and impacts on wetlands and wildlife. So to briefly respond to these, the approval criteria for a zoning map amendment specifically states that no plan is required, or that if no plan is provided, that the service providers would base the finding of adequate services on the most intense use of the property. In this case, it would be the maximum density under the proposed zoning, or approximately 82 lots for single-family homes. A complete review of services within the site would be conducted when a specific development proposal comes in for, say, a land division or plan development. At that time, the applicant would be required to provide a specific utility plan, street plan, et cetera, meeting all standards and approval criteria. And there's no guarantee that they would get 82 lots or any number, specific number of lots to make that happen. Again, the approval criteria also find that adequacy, or state that adequacy of services applies only to the specific zone change site. So you can't look at the overall area and development potential in the area. You need to focus on just this zone change site. And then the neighborhood also raised concerns that there were some proposals in the pipeline that might not have been accounted for by the service bureaus. Of those, a small number, 27 units, would really just represent assumed growth in the area and would not have a significant impact on services. In terms of the environmental impacts, there really are no approval criteria for the represented. I have a couple more minutes just to finish it off. There really are no approval criteria for the requested zoning map amendment related to environmental impacts. Again, it specifically looks at adequacy of public services. And as I stated earlier, these issues will be evaluated as relevant to any proposal that comes in the future for a specific development of the site. Just quickly go over the alternatives. Again, would be to deny the appeal and uphold the hearings officer decision, deny the appeal and make modifications to the hearings officer decision, or uphold the appeal and overturn the hearings officer's decision. A couple of process issues. As the city attorney already mentioned, the appeal is on the record, so no new evidence should be considered. And the 120-day time limit for this application would run out on April 18th. So we should have adequate time to process if we need to come back one more time. Thank you. Do you have?
Well, I do. I'm just trying to still get my arms around this issue, and I hear the issue of the approval criteria not necessarily taking into account a proposed development, that those issues are addressed at the time that the application submitted for the proposed development. But I guess I'm just curious. I just assumed if we had a designated wetlands area or a designated flood zone, that notwithstanding it not being designated with an overlay, that there were certain conditions that property owners had to meet, including not altering that landscape. And what I'm hearing you say is unless they have an overlay zone, even if we identify them as flood zones or wetlands, they are free to fill those in and develop on them as though they didn't exist. Those conditions didn't exist.
They are, like I said, required to go to the appropriate jurisdiction for permitting a fill of a wetland without environmental zoning are the state and federal agencies. The grading permit that's in with the city for this property will not be issued until they can show us that the permits, that they have the proper permits from the other agencies, but there's no mechanism for city staff to review whether or not it's appropriate for these water, for the wetlands on the site to be filled and what, how they would be mitigated for, et cetera.
Because we didn't.
Because there is no environmental zoning.
So that gets back to, I guess, why that didn't happen. And if that doesn't happen, that means we forego any opportunity to regulate
Right. What's
done on the site.
One thing that might be helpful is I know that there is a staff person from the Bureau of Environmental Services who is familiar with the wetlands on the site and can probably talk to you a little bit about what their condition and value is, and maybe you know that might play in somewhat to why they didn't get environmental zoning. The applicant is a longtime property owner. He may know some of that history as to why that happened. They don't have environmental zoning now, so they don't have protection.
I had a question. I noticed on the map that most of the property surrounding this is R10.
Yes.
And that some of that R10 property either has wetlands or is in the 100-year floodplain that is already designated R10.
Yes. And I want to, you're looking at the one that's labeled City GIS map.
That and the one that was on the screen a few minutes ago, it actually had the pictures of the wetland or the floodplain, I can't remember which, on it, that was outside this specific area we're discussing, but adjacent to it and having an R10 designation.
I'm just going to go back to that. One thing that I have to caution is that these aren't official delineations of wetlands or floodplain. They are, you know, our GIS layer that we use as a kind of guide. I have recently seen a map that doesn't show the wetland area coming down that far south, but this is based on a National Wetland Inventory map that was digitized and placed in the city GIS system. But yes, there are other areas that are currently zoned for a higher density that may be in the floodplain in the area. Properties that are in the floodplain can be developed with a single, if they have a current lot, they can be developed with a single home as long as they meet building code requirements for a finished floor elevation above the floodplain.
But you can build, they can actually take a permit out and build on the lot that's been subdivided in the floodplain as long
as... you couldn't, under current regulations, and this was put in place in 2002 when the new land division code went into effect. Under current regulations, you cannot divide, in single family zones, you can't divide a property where you'll have building areas within the floodplain. So what's happening on this property is essentially, I believe the applicant is trying to prepare the property for a future land division application by creating buildable area outside the floodplain.
Did I hear you say that since 2002 you can't divide property into lots within a floodplain?
In single dwelling zones.
And yes. Is that what this is?
Yes.
Then I'm a little confused because I thought you said we could create 89 lots versus the 9
lots.
Well,
this is just this is a zoning map amendment looking at whether or not services can be provided for that number of units on the property.
Okay.
If they come back with a land division application on this property with building areas in the floodplain, no, we could not approve it.
But I thought I also heard you say they were applying to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for a fill permit to fill in the wetlands. Thus, does that remove that as an issue if it's filled in?
It would. The idea...
do we let anybody who has a lot that's in a floodplain or wetlands fill in on the lot to raise it above the floodplain or wetlands and then build?
There are regulations about that, and probably I better refer you to, I do have a staff person from the site development section who can answer those questions about the requirements. There are requirements for balance, cut, and fill. And they are considered still in the floodplain until they go to FEMA and actually get remapped and taken out. So we consider them in the floodplain until they go through that official process. Beyond that, the technical aspects of what's allowed in terms of filling floodplain, I don't have the technical expertise to answer that. Because there's no environmental zoning on the property or any other protections, you can take out a grading permit and change the property if you don't have any other overlays.
So even if we identify any piece of property in the city as being in a floodplain or as a wetland, unless we've, in addition to that, designated it as an environmental zone, there's no protection of it per se. I mean, a landowner can go in and modify the landscape with fill so that it's no longer in a floodplain. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, they have to get proper permits, and there is the balanced cut and fill. So depending on the property, that wouldn't always be possible. But generally, yes, you can apply for a permit to change the property to create area outside of a floodplain. I don't know how often that happens. Again,
maybe I've just not been paying attention, but this appears to be fairly unique in the land use terms I've sat through. So that's why I'm asking the questions.
Right. I haven't ever had, seen a site where this has been proposed or occurred.
So it isn't just me?
No.
Okay.
It's both you and the issue.
So the desired zoning designation is R10H. What is the H?
That is related to the airport height restriction. I don't believe it would really have any impact here based on the height limit for the zone anyway.
Other questions? Thank you. Now we'll hear from the appellant.
I don't know where best to put this. My map's a little different. This is the property here. I guess we need to say who I am and all those things.
Okay, why don't you come over to the middle so we can get a better view?
I'd really rather hide, don't
I? Ina, you have 11 minutes. That's how long the staff presentation took.
Okay.
For your opening.
My name is Mary Helen Kincaid. I'm the chairperson of the East Columbia Neighborhood Association and also the chairperson of the Land Use Committee.
I just want to point out a couple things on the map. I don't know the proper way to do this. This is my first foray into printing on a design jet wide format printer. So this map is from Portland Maps Online, the property. The dark blue is the floodplain, according to that map, and the little striped areas, and they don't really show in real well, are wetlands on those maps. So as you, I don't have a way to compare it to Stephanie's map, but it's a little bit different, and it shows a little more wetlands. And this little light blue horseshoe, or it looks like a head bone area, is called a water body. So that, and according to that map, it's a permanent, permanently filled water body. And the other feature I wanted to point out in here is these wetlands here are on private property. They were part of the mitigated wetlands when these houses were built here. So I might make a point to that later, but had I known PowerPoint was possible, I probably would have done that. Sorry. I'm losing up my 11 minutes. I don't know how many of you know this, but our neighborhood has a strong history of a passion to preserve wetlands and open space. We're a very small neighborhood, only about 600 residences. I'm assuming that you know sort of the boundaries of where we are, so I don't need to do that. And a lot of the neighbors are very concerned about the wildlife corridors that are being affected by development and the natural areas. A little bit of history. Some of this is neighborhood institutional history, but of course, we all know about the 1948 Vanport flood. Many houses established in this neighborhood were inundated with water. Some floated away before there was the levee. They floated over to the airport and were brought back. Some of those same residents live there now. In 1971, this area was annexed to the city, or most of the area. Part of the Bridgeton area, I understand, was not along Marine Drive, and I don't know the technicalities there. In 1990, the East Columbia Natural Resources Management Plan was created and adopted by City Council. And fast forward to 2002, our neighborhood received a Columbia SLU Award for stewardship of those three mitigated ponds that I showed you in the development. Neighbors formed a group, and we've maintained those on a private basis. And the Columbia SLU Watershed Council recognized that accomplishment. Just last year, two of our neighbors that were going to be here today because of illness couldn't, Dick and Jareed Toll, received an award for their leadership in spearheading enhancements to our one and only park in the neighborhood, the Arboretum. And this included enhancements to drainage ways, some bridge crossings over areas that were inaccessible, and some waterway enhancements. And just this year, East Columbia on April 7th will receive an award, the Bill Nato Award, for our work in preserving trees in our Children's Arboretum. The Children's Arboretum was once an overgrown blackberry and filled with invasive species, and neighbors have taken on the project to clear out the area, create pathways, have worked with the Portland Parks Bureau, Metro, many private corporations in the area to make that a better place. Our natural resources plan is guidance that we've used for protecting our natural wetlands and open space in the neighborhood, and we hope to work with the Bureau of Planning to update that in the future because much has changed in the neighborhood since the 1990s. Over 400 homes have been built since that plan was adopted. Former farmland and horse farms have been developed into industrial use and single-family dwellings, and many impervious surfaces have been created, and there's a large industrial complex just south of Gertz Road and Fazio Way that's been built up in that area that's paved over what many longtime residents know as a Fazio farm property where he used to buy produce. Stephanie alluded to our concern, and we say this as often and as we can, that there are 5 cases and permits for proposals in this area. And it combined, they make 150 single-family dwellings on 55 acres. Much of it, the proposed areas are in the floodplain, near bordering wetlands and drainage ways. I can kind of point those out to you. Of course, this property here, this is all Columbia Edgewater Golf Course. This piece of property right here is at a pre-application stage, but their proposal is for 49 houses. This area along here is for 17 houses, and this here is for 4 houses. And this piece of property here is for 16 houses. And then, of course, there's the 82 houses, which is what we have to use for the projection, because that's what the city said to use. We know that the zone change is a quasi-judicial process. We've, you know, been explained that. And it became a new vocabulary term because a lot of us were really new to land use and still, I guess, in infancy stages at this point. And we also know that it's not possible to separate or combine or put two together. But we hope that this serves as a stepping stone to the review of the comp plan that's going on and the Portland City plan, and that this might be a perfect opportunity for utilizing some new energy that's able to look at a holistic approach to this area. If you just single out this one property, it's possible that you can see that it would have an impact on the whole neighborhood if surfaces were filled. In a letter of January 16th, the attorney for Dr. Brandwein, the landowners, he stated that the neighborhood's rezoning argument, which is really our wanting to combine everything or make the zoning a little bit different that more fit the land that's there now, could have happened when the city amended its comprehensive plan in the 1990s. Well, if we all had that wonderful foresight as opposed to hindsight, we could have done a lot of things better, and we know that we can go forward, but with the current process, it's just not possible to jump in the middle of when you get a land use review and then jump into a comprehensive plan change and have it affect anything, given the timelines. We know that this area has changed, and so we believe that there needs to be some attention given to that change of the land. I think some of you saw the challenges that we have in wetlands area and drainage. I want to speak a little bit to the floodplain and wetlands because that's been the most biggest concern of our neighborhood. The three delineated wetlands in there is wetland A is the largest one here is what in many reports is referred to as wetland A. It's 6 acres. According to a consultant's report done by a consultant for the landowner, it says it's seasonally flooded, but the neighbors that live on either side of this said that there's always water in there, sometimes lower in the summer, but that there's always water in there. Wetland B is a smaller area here. It's 1 acre in size and seasonally filled with water and does dry up cattails and other trees that have grown in there. And wetland C is this area that's the permanently flooded wetland that's been... that contains hydric soils and also in some of their tests what they call raft and silt loam, and I've come to know that that's some sort of historic soil that only builds up over years, and if there's an expert, maybe he can explain that more. At some point in time, tiles were placed in this pond. I think Stephanie pointed to the fact that the landowner is going to has filled cut-and-fill requirement, cut-and-fill permits, to fill that permanently flooded pond is the one that they want to fill to build on top of, as well as part of the floodplain that's in that area. In that same January 16th letter, Mr. Kobach's, the attorneys, stated that they, meaning the neighborhood association, do not link the existence of any resources to the relevant criteria. We contend that because of these wetlands, that services that are brought to the site would not be able to be built because of the existence of the wetlands and the floodplain. It's sort of a catch-22 situation. We can say that the services are there, but can they actually be brought to the site? And we don't believe that they can be because of the existence of the depth of the water, the depth of the flood, the existence of the floodplain. And we don't believe that it can be absolutely determined that stormwater facilities, streets, sanitary sewer, water services that potentially could be located in what was a floodplain or is a floodplain will and would be able to be service provision to that site, and can they be located in a floodplain, and can they be located and designed to minimize or eliminate flood damage to those services? And was that part of it ever considered by the bureaus, that even though there are services to the street, are they capable of going onto the site and actually being services? Uh-oh, I'm over.
Nope, you have a minute.
Okay. I'm going to skip over the transportation issue because there's like 50-page reports, and from a neighborhood standpoint, it was really difficult for us to deal with. But basically, I want to respond to a statement that was made in a rebuttal to the hearing that said that they didn't know where the neighborhood got their numbers. We did sort of an on-the-ground. We went out. Somebody sat in a lawn chair one morning from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m., counted the number of cars at the intersection, did a mathematical projection, said this many people live in the neighborhood, this many people left. Projected that to the, if there were 82 houses, because that was the figure we had to use, so the figure of 50% of the people, so 41 people left, and we figured 41 people would have to come back. That would make 82 trips each day. The consultant's report came up with a figure of 49. There's one intersection that's already an F intersection, and that's Northeast 6th of the Marine Drive. So we would be adding 82 more trips to that intersection. Am I done now?
If you wanted to wrap
something
up. I just
have a couple quick things to cover. The sanitary sewer system, BES has indicated that there is an existing public sewer to the with available capacity for a land, but they said with a land division. So we have a little bit of a problem with that because they've stepped into the land division, but we can't consider land division because that's part of the development. But they would be required to extend the public sewer to the individual lots. And can this be done with, so if that's the case, can it be done with the constraints of the land being, again, the wetlands and the floodplains? Currently on the site, there are septic tanks and no sewer line into the property. The stormwater management
You're going to have to wrap it up.
Okay. Let me just read our closing statement because a lot of people put this together. We believe that the unique qualities and constraints of this property will not allow service to be provided to the site without destroying natural resources. We would support any proposal that is made to build dwellings to fit the land. We do not support destruction of natural resources for the purpose of building single-family dwellings. There are far too many alternatives available for building in sensitive areas. This should not be a case of looking at land without the unique qualities and following set responses. Special care needs to be used to look at the feasibility of providing services to a piece of land with three delineated wetlands, a natural stream, and bordered by drainage ways. We're only seeking a solution that is a result of negotiation that would preserve wetlands, open space, and vital stormwater runoff resources while providing dwelling units that provide an opportunity to build housing in a unique setting for our future neighbors. That's it. I don't have any questions. Sort of read really fast.
Thank you. Are there persons who have signed up who support the appeal?
I have two people signed up, Christopher Kobach and Kathy Humble. Okay, you probably signed up on the wrong list then. Okay, Kathy Humble.
Thank you for being here. State your name when you speak, and you have 3 minutes.
My name is Kathy Humble, and I lived in the neighborhood in question for 30 years. I support the appeal by our neighborhood association because I believe it's not possible to provide adequate services for the proposed level of density. The key factors are the degree to which this area is wetland and the challenges that presents for building and maintaining storm sewer systems. It's easy enough for the hearings officer or council members to approve this density, but in this neighborhood, the key services are provided by the Peninsula Drainage District, their extensive network of drainage ditches and pumps. I understand that they reviewed the proposal. I also understand that the preliminary stormwater report for the site does not have a detailed site utility plan or details of how the treatment of the stormwater will be handled and the effect it will have on neighboring bodies of water. So that's what they were looking at. The landowner's stormwater report does not indicate what the outlet structure will be for the runoff, and indicates only three grassy swales for the proposed building area of 82 single-family dwellings. So the bottom line is that the effect of your decision falls on the shoulders of the Peninsula Drainage District more than on direct city-run services. Mary Helen talked about foresight versus hindsight. Let's not lay the groundwork for a flood 10 years down the pike. Let's have the foresight now to think through this decision thoroughly enough in advance. That's all I have.
Thank you. We'll now hear from the principal opponent or the applicant. Could you please come forward? You have a total of 17 minutes.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honor, members of council. My name is Christopher Kobach again, K-O-B-A-C-K. I represent the applicant, Dr. Howard Brandwein, who is seated to my left. I just want to start out by reminding the decision makers what the application is. And this is an application to zone a piece of property to be consistent with a comprehensive plan. It was designated as residential 10 in the early 90s in a comprehensive plan, which was a formal process, and I assume great thought was placed upon the designation. We are not here to talk about what's going to be on the land in a year, 2 years, 5 years. The staff report and the decision in this case are clear. There are other processes that have to take place before anything can be placed on the property. Those will require permits, analysis, and an applicant that meets a burden of proof before they determine what can be placed on the property. The question here is, has the criteria been met to zone the property formally on the zoning map so that it matches the designation on the comprehensive plan? The code, the city code at section 33.855.050, contains that criteria. The first criteria is one I just mentioned. It asks whether or not the comprehensive map is consistent with the request, and it is. The comprehensive map shows the property as RR10. The second one is the criteria that we've actually spent most of the time with below and in this appeal, which we should be spending our time on, and that is whether there's adequate services to support the new zone. And the important point of that criteria, I think, is this sentence. It says adequacy of services is determined by the service bureaus who apply the demand numbers to the actual and proposed services to the site and surrounding area. There are professionals that are employed by the city who run bureaus and whose job it is to look at requests of this nature and make assessments. And in this case, they were given information that the maximum density would be 82 lots. That was used as the demand number because, as I said, there isn't a proposal for a specific development. So if you take the 22 acres and multiply the density, you'd come up with about 87 lots. Most people that considered this test subtracted about 15% for internal roads. The only people that didn't use 82 lots, I think, was our traffic engineer who used 87. And so he was even more conservative than the city experts. In the record, you will have evidence that every service bureau that considered this found, based upon the projected demand of 82 lots, there were adequate services to support the zoning. So that the evidence in the record shows that that criteria was met. You did not hear today, and I don't think if you look at the record, you will find any substantial evidence that those professionals that work for the city were wrong. Substantial evidence, I think, is defined as evidence that a reasonable person can rely upon in making a decision. And the Service Bureau personnel provided that, and the opponents to this appeal have not. The other criteria, one is whether it applies if the zone is in an IR zone or if the property is in an IR zone, and that does not apply. And the last one is whether the site is within the city boundary, which it is. So based upon the applicable criteria and the evidence in the record, we would ask that you affirm the hearings officer's decision and approve the specific request. We encourage you not to make your decision based upon the existence of wetlands that have not been protected under the city conservation zoning or on the existence of other natural features that may impact future development but are not contained within the relevant criteria for the application that's before you. Mr. Brandwein is well aware of the constraints on the property. As staff alluded to, there are applications with relevant jurisdictions, the Division of State Lands, and the Army Corps of Engineers that will address existing natural features on the land. If those permits are granted in a way that allows less than 82 lots, that will be the constraints that face the developer when they come back for a subdivision application. If those permits are not granted, I think it's safe to assume that the development would be significantly limited. But that is an issue that's not before us today, and we would encourage the council to make its decision based upon the relevant criteria. Unless there are any questions, I think that's our presentation.
I have a question.
Yes.
On the hearings officer's decision, I don't know if you have it there.
I do.
Page 3, 1-2, third paragraph, last sentence. In the analysis section, he comments that the hearings officer is precluded from considering what might occur during the upcoming comprehensive plan review. So do I interpret that to mean that we have to look at this application today as the conditions exist and we can't anticipate what may or may not happen in the future to modify or not the approval criteria?
To modify the approval criteria for the zone change?
He is speaking to the zone change, and he's speaking to the neighborhood's argument about what may happen during the upcoming comprehensive plan review. And what I inferred from that comment was that he is precluded from anticipating what may or may not happen, what future conditions might be. You can't necessarily anticipate what the development might be. In other words, may or may not be. You have to just look strictly at the criteria for a zone change and whether or not services can be provided based on the existing conditions.
Well, I didn't interpret that comment the same way. What I interpreted that comment to mean was the hearings officer was in more of a vague way alluding to the goalpost rule, which is in Oregon statutes 227178, and it says that even if there's a change in the law, for example, even if the comprehensive plan were changed tomorrow to designate this property differently, since the application was filed before that change in the law, the statute I just referenced says that this applicant is entitled to have his application decided based upon the criteria that was in place when his application was deemed complete by the city. And so I think that's what the hearings officer was alluding to in that specific comment.
I think I'm saying the same thing. So we can't anticipate what may or may not happen in the future. We have to look at what the conditions are today.
Under the Oregon state law, you're required to decide the application based upon the law that was in place when Mr. Brandwein filed, irregardless of whether or not that law changes in the future, or even if you can expect it to change, you're bound to apply the law that was in place when he applied.
And to take that another step, we can't necessarily take into consideration what may or may not should be approved in terms of a development after the zoning change occurs as part of our decision making on this application.
I think that's for a different reason. It's not relevant criteria. So I think that's right. There will be another application, for example, that has the number of lots, and it will have to show, as staff said, a detail of where the sewer is going to be, where the water is going to be, and if the wetlands stay where they're at, there's going to be limitations that apply. If the permit is granted that allows one wetland to be filled, and I think this is not outside the record because you can take official notice of the state regulations, but DSL requires mitigation. So while one wetland may be filled to facilitate a certain element of development, it has to be mitigated somewhere else on the site.
So I can't take that into consideration in terms of whether I support or not support this current application.
Exactly. Okay. Any more than you can take into consideration they're there.
Okay. So can I turn you to page 8 then, understanding the context of the discussion we just had? And the hearings officer notes that the Portland Department of Transportation initially objected to the application. And I'm on the last paragraph on page 8. And about halfway through the paragraph, he says that one intersection at Northeast 6th Drive and Northeast Philomena Road and Northeast Marine Drive was found to operate as service F, with or without the proposed zone change. Portland Transportation raised concerns about this rating because it could not or would not meet city standards. He then, on the next page, says no additional street dedication of adjacent properties would be needed to install the turn lanes. Therefore, improvements to the intersection could be made in the future as a condition of approval associated with a development proposal. So in that, what I'm reading there is him taking a different direction, saying, well, if I were to look at this today as it existed, PDOT doesn't think that this development can go forward, but in the future, whatever proposed development comes down through BDS needs to have as a condition of approval some way to address this failing intersection. So because I believe that will be true, and I'm just reading this into his remarks, I'm going to go ahead and conclude that that criteria was met. So I find that troublesome. I mean, he appears to be saying two different things in his decision. I can't be put in a place where I have to pass judgment on what may or may not be developed on the property in terms of wetlands. On the other hand, PDOT said there's a failing intersection here. We don't think there should be any more development, but he's saying, I'm going to go ahead and approve this zone change, even though PDOT has said that this is a failing intersection. Hopefully, and I noticed in his conclusion, didn't even include this as a criteria, but hopefully so that the future application will have as a condition some remediation to this failing intersection.
I think if you read this paragraph and the evidence that supports it carefully, what the hearings officer decided and what the PDOT official testified supported was the fact that this intersection is not going to be failing because of this proposal.
But says it is, but I mean,
it's going to fail no matter what it says.
It's failing now.
It is.
Yeah.
Not because of any traffic generated by this rezone. There's one maneuver.
PDOT, in his comments here, he's indicating PDOT raised concerns with the zone change because it is a failing intersection.
Right. But PDOT did not say as part of this rezone it has to be fixed, because I think PDOT recognized this development isn't causing that. It's a bigger issue for the city.
It'll add to that. I mean, it exacerbates an existing failing intersection. Obviously, if you have more development, if you have 82 more dwelling units added onto an intersection that is currently failing, how does that do nothing but make it fail more?
Because if the evidence was that no cars from this development will take the maneuver that's causing that intersection to fail. And that's why you have to look at this. There's one maneuver that caused that intersection to fail. It was a left from 6th onto Marine.
That's all it takes to have a fatal accident is one maneuver, one time.
Right, but the evidence was that no cars from this development would make that maneuver.
I don't see that here.
That's in the staff report, and it's in the record.
Sure, point that out to me.
If you look at the submission from the January 9th,
so where do we have that?
Mine are, the city put numbers on them. It's a January 9th letter from traffic engineer Mike R. to Bob Haley, the city of Portland.
I don't know that I have that.
It is one of the exhibits that came in on the open record period, and I don't know what number the city gave it.
I can probably find it.
It's
while she's looking, why don't you describe what it says?
What's the January 8th letter? It came with my January 9th letter to the city. Actually, it was the first report of December 11th, Stephanie. December 11th, 2007.
Again, I'm specifically looking for something that addressed.